This is 1A. I'm David Gura in for Jen White. All this month, 1A's hit list has been looking at the best pop culture of 2020. Today, we wrap it all up with a look at TV and film. Pandemic restrictions have been in place off and on since March. So how did Hollywood handle it? Eric Deggans is NPR's TV critic. He joins us now. Welcome back to 1A. Hey, Eric.
Thanks for having me.
John Horn hosts a show about arts and culture called The Frame on KPCC, Southern California Public Radio. Hey, John.
Hey there. How are you?
I'm good. And Brooke Obi is an award-winning film critic and author. Brooke, welcome back to you, too.
Thanks so much for having me.
John, let me start with what's happening on the ground where you are, out in Los Angeles. I saw that the L.A. County Health Department has asked the film and TV industry to strongly consider pausing due to the recent COVID-19 surge in L.A. For those who don't know, myself among them, what's the state of the pandemic there and how's it affecting industry?
Well, it's still, you know, affecting a lot of things. I mean, the problem right now is that production has been either very slow or non-existent over the last, you know, nine or so months. Some movies have gotten made, like the next Jurassic Park movie has wrapped. It'll come out probably now in 2022, because so many studios have moved their films out of 2020 into 2021. We know that Warner Brothers put all of their films on streaming services like HBO Max in addition to theaters. So right now, you know, companies like Netflix, because they do so many different language translations, they're about a year to like 10 months ahead of everybody else. But if we continue where we are right now, and obviously the pandemic has never been worse, there's going to be no content on major TV networks and movie studios come like the third quarter of next year. So it's really going to be a problem because people can't get together. They can't shoot. Animation continues, but live action production is pretty much ground to a halt, both in TV and in film.
Brooke, John's talking about there being no content just a few quarters away, and I just wonder if you could help us understand what that means from a financial perspective. I mean, this has been a seismic change for the film and TV industries.
Oh, absolutely. And I think that these networks are going to have to be looking for some very clever and creative solutions in order to deal with that. This is definitely going to be a financial hit.
Eric, what about TV? And we think about these big budget films and John mentioning Jurassic Park, its latest iteration, you know, work continues. That's likely to still come out. What's it meant for TV? How has production slowed there? And what's it meant for the sort of the rollout of programming on TV?
Yeah, I think broadcast TV in particular was hit the hardest by the pandemic because they have the greatest need to create a flow, a continuing flow of new material. The first lockdowns happened in the middle of March, which not only kept a lot of TV shows from filming the last episodes of their season run back then, it also stopped them from creating pilots for new episodes of television. So they had many fewer new shows to choose from when we got to the end of the year and they tried to have a new fall season. What we're hearing now is that some shows, a lot of shows tried to get back into production around the end of November and the beginning of December, but we're already hearing that productions have stopped and pushed back the time when they're going to resume production after the Christmas break because of the rising outbreaks in California and the sense that it's getting harder to contain the virus. I think we really won't see production return to normal until there's a widespread use of the vaccine particularly in Hollywood, in Los Angeles, and in these production centers in Atlanta as well. Now, Tyler Perry actually showed how this could work. He created a bubble where he imported all of his staffers, all of his performers, all of his technicians, and they basically lived inside a bubble for about 2 months while they were recording various seasons of a couple different TV shows that he controls. So if it doesn't get better, I would not be surprised to see some TV outlets try to do that, create their own bubbles where they would have production for maybe a month and everyone would live inside the bubble so they could be sure that they could get through a season of television, a reduced season of episodes without risking everyone's health.
Eric, have you seen more of that out in L.A., that kind of entrepreneurship that Tyler Perry was experimenting with, I imagine, in Atlanta? How has that entrepreneurship sort of manifested itself on the ground in L.A.? How have studios continued to be able to produce so much as they have?
Well, I mean, from my perspective, there was an agreement reached between the unions about COVID-19 protocols, and so a lot of production, TV productions, kind of eased back into production, but they did have problems with outbreaks. You know, a cast member from The Good Doctor, for example, was diagnosed positive with COVID while they were in production, and so I think they've tried to step up production slowly, but they have run into snags as people on crews and sometimes even performers have tested positive. And again, like I said, what I've heard is that there's going to be a pause on production until maybe the second week of January for a lot of shows.
Brooke, I want to ask you about demand and how the industry has reacted to changes in demand. We were talking about broadcast television a little while back. Speaking for myself, I've been doing so much more streaming. I imagine that what we've seen over these last 9-10 months has been an acceleration of trends that had been in place or had been forecasted. How have studios adjusted to the way that we consume content, the way we watch TV, the way we watch movies?
Well, I honestly believe that Warner Brothers is adjusting the best in putting all of their movies on streaming. People are just not going to be going to the theaters anytime soon. And so I thought that, there is a lot to be worked out there. And there are obviously some contract issues that should definitely be addressed, and people should be informed that those things are going to be happening. But definitely, there is such a high demand. People can now binge watch entire series thanks to Netflix in a day or a weekend. And so, we're all at home. Hopefully, we will continue to stay at home until this virus is under control. And so the demand is extremely high for content, for things to do within our homes safely. And so hopefully studios will continue to adjust to that and provide the material that they were maybe hoping to put in these theaters onto streaming platforms.
We're talking with Brooke Obie. She's an award-winning film critic and author, along with Eric Deggans, NPR's TV critic, and John Horn, the host of KPCC's The Frame. And John, listening to that, I think of these movie theaters that have been largely shuttered. Certainly the one in my neighborhood has been for many months now, and we're hearing from major chains like AMC. They're kind of raising the specter of bankruptcy, perhaps. Have we seen the end of movie theaters, at least in the way that we've had them before? I mentioned trends accelerating just a moment ago. What does the future look like for a theater owner in light of what we just heard from Brooke there about HBO Max sort of doing things, streaming movies now, going to stream movies that are going to be in theaters as well?
I don't know what is the word that is worse than bleak or desperate. The third quarter for movie theaters a year ago, $2.8 billion in North America in tickets sold. This year, $116 million. I mean, it's collapsed. The business has absolutely vanished. And you have chains like AMC that have, leases. They have, rents. They have overhead. And they're not getting any money in. And the real problem for theater owners right now, it's not just that, people aren't going to theaters because of the quarantine. The studios are either doing what Warner Brothers is doing, releasing things day and date on a streaming platform, or they're postponing their films until more theaters open. So you have essentially this catch-22 where the theaters don't want to open until they have a lot of product. The studios don't want to release movies until there are a lot of theaters open. None of that's going to happen while we're in the grips of this horrible surge in the pandemic. So the studios are saying, well, we're not going to wait. And I think this is forcing a change that was inevitable anyway. I mean, movie theater attendance has been either flat or declining over the past decade. And the theater owners were very reluctant to embrace any kind of model that dealt with streaming. They always said, if you want to play a movie in our theaters, it has to be in our theaters for about 70 days minimum before it can appear on a streaming service. Companies like Netflix, Amazon Prime said that doesn't work for our business model. And the theater owner said, okay, well, then we're not going to show Roma. We're not going to show your best movies. And that, I think, really kind of forced streaming to benefit because people wanted to see those films and they didn't care. I've got two kids. They don't care what anything's playing. They don't need to go to a theater. They just want to watch it now. And theaters have clung to the same model since they opened. If you want to see this movie, you got to come Tuesday night at 8:30. And that's it. And the world is different. And I think theater owners didn't change. They wanted companies like Netflix and Amazon to change for them. They said no, and now the theater owners are really hanging on by their fingernails.
Eric Deggans, you're my TV guy, and I wonder how you process all of this. I mean, you're seeing your world change so much, the world of TV changing so much. These movies are going to be released on TV. How does that change your work? How do you observe that as a TV guy, sort of the encroachment of movies on TV earlier than it used to?
Man, it's just, it's a fire hose of content. It's like keeping up with this stuff is just incredibly challenging. It was already challenging before the pandemic, but now as more media companies align their inner structure to enable more streaming, it just means more and more of these projects are getting pushed towards streaming. You know, this is something, my good friends at NPR who cover movies, you know, we've always tussled over this. I've always said to them, you know, that this was an inevitable change, that you know, people are raising the bar on how much hassle they want to endure to see a movie in a theater. And the pandemic has just forced that change to intensify. And the thing I'm worried about is that communal experience of sitting in a theater and watching something wonderful may diminish or even go away for smaller communities.
That's Eric Deggans. He's NPR's TV critic. John Horn is the host of KPCC's The Frame. Brooke Obie is an award-winning film critic and author. Coming up, it's been a tough year for Hollywood, as we've been discussing, but it's still offered up some fantastic shows and movies. We're going to break down the best of the best after this. I'm David Gura. This is 1A from WAMU and NPR. This is 1A. I'm David Gura, in for Jen White today. And saying this year has been crazy is an understatement. But some standout performances and well-timed masterpieces have made the year a little bit brighter. Here with us to break down the year's best TV and movies is Eric Deggans. He's NPR's TV critic. John Horn is the host of KPCC's The Frame. And Brooke Obie is an award-winning film critic and author. We also want to hear from you. What's been your favorite movie or TV show released this year? And why do you love it so much? You can comment on our Facebook page, tweet us at 1A, or send us an email, 1A@WAMU.org. Brooke, I want to ask you just how our tastes have changed over the course of the last year. We were talking about sort of how we consume TV and movies has changed. But what about what exactly we're watching, the types of shows, the types of movies we're watching? Any observations you have about how we've looked at those things during this pandemic year?
Sure. So it seems like now Hollywood is basically catching up to our tastes as viewers. Viewers have always been hungry for marginalized people's stories to be centered, for different perspectives to be centered. And now we have so many stories and so much more representation, whether it's race, class. We have so many great foreign films that have been given mainstream success in America over the past few years. And so it's just been great to see, and it's been great for Hollywood to acknowledge that we are hungry for these stories and that we want to see them, and providing the funding and the resources to not only get these productions made, but also distributed and promoted so that we know where these stories are and where to find them.
Eric Deggans, curious what you think about that as well, this issue of representation. And I should note, yes, it's been a pandemic year, but we had these protests over the summer after the death of George Floyd. That led to discussions about how marginalized communities in film and on television are portrayed. Are you seeing noticeable changes when you look at what's coming out, what's come out?
Yeah, most definitely. You know, I'm somebody, as an African-American and a longtime TV and media critic, I've been covering this for a long time. And what I've seen this year is more people of color getting development deals, getting placed in situations where they have control over the stories they're telling. Some of the most anticipated and best executed shows of this year have not only featured a cast of color, but you know, the executive producer, the creator, the directors, you know, a lot of people behind the scenes are also people of color. And I think part of that is that, you know, younger audiences in particular want their media products to reflect the diversity that they see in their lives. And the way to get authenticity, like authenticity is the coin of the realm in media right now. It's one reason why kids flock to a certain artist on TikTok or, you know, someone who's making waves in other parts of media. They sense something authentic about that person. And so if you want an authentic depiction of the experience of people of color, you have to find creators and producers and directors and performers of color to create that. So one thing TV has done is stepped up, and we've even seen a network like CBS that was highly criticized for years for its lack of diversity, pledged this year that its scripted and unscripted shows were going to have a definitive described level of diversity, I think 50%. You know, to ensure that they are going along with this trend that the rest of the industry saw coming years ago.
Let's talk a bit about what some of your favorites were. Eric, I'll start with you. You're looking at TV. What were your, let's say, top three favorite TV shows of the year?
Top three favorite. Well, you know, again, to talk about diversity. And this was really tough because there was a lot of stuff out there. But my favorite show was Lovecraft Country. And this was a show on HBO that sort of placed a black family at the center of a supernatural slash horror story where there was often allegories drawn between racism and horrific monsters and beings from sorcery. The Queen's Gambit on Netflix, this great story of a female chess champion trying to win the world championship in the 1950s and 1960s. So it talked a lot about sexism and class and things like that. And then The Mandalorian on Disney Plus, which was this amazing story where they structured the story around characters from the Star Wars universe that had kind of been overlooked or underexplored in the big movies. And in that process, they managed to revitalize a franchise that a lot of fans had been disappointed with for a long time. So that's my top three.
John, how about you? Top three favorite movies of the year?
It's, you know, it was slim pickings, mostly, because a lot of films were passed into the next year, but there were some films that played at the Sundance Film Festival earlier this year. And this is, Eric kind of mentioned, like, what is TV, what is film, that kind of fight. So one of my top films that some people think is a TV show is Small Axe, Steve McQueen's five-film series on Amazon. I thought it was tremendously important filmmaking. It was really well done. I thought every little film was distinct in its own way, and I think it's really required viewing for understanding kind of the global issues around racism and oppression. I'm going to say of the kind of bigger studio films, Nomadland, which will come out, I think, now in February. This is a movie directed by Chloe Zhao, who made The Rider. It stars Frances McDormand, but it really stars people who are from Jessica Bruder's book of the same name, Nomadland. These are people who have, they're not homeless, they're houseless. There are people who have lost pretty much everything owing to, you know, the Great Recession or some other life incident. And there's this community of people who go from job to job, you know, RV park to RV park, trying to get by. And it's a beautiful moving film that also feels incredibly relevant. And then I'm going to add a documentary called 76 Days, which was about, you know, the pandemic. It was four camera crews that were embedded in hospitals in Wuhan, China. The access to the patients and the care is remarkable. You don't really meet the doctors or the nurses because they're fully gowned and masked. But it really is a story about the dedication of people who are trying to treat victims of the pandemic. It's a remarkable film. It's called 76 Days.
Turn to Brooke here in just a sec, but we're getting some emails and some tweets from listeners. Chandra is saying some of her favorite TV shows were Mrs. America, Never Have I Ever, and The Crown. Latest season of The Crown came out during the course of all of this. And then Kat tweets, I loved the second season of Afterlife by Ricky Gervais. I think it was brilliant and touched my life. Brooke, how about your favorites, TV and movies, if you want to do both?
Okay, my favorite TV shows definitely have to start with I May Destroy You. Michaela Cole is just operating on another level. And it's just so fantastic to see her in this dramedy where she is taking a trauma that really happened to her and fictionalizing it and walking us through that trauma and showing us about rape culture, about the boundaries in our society that we allow, what we should allow, what we shouldn't. It just offers so many questions to help us dig deeper and to become better human beings, better support to each other, and a better community for the world. So it's just, it's fantastic, fantastic, sharp television right there. P-Valley also, fantastic storytelling. Here again, you're centering Black women, sex workers in a southern town, dealing with issues of class and race, but it's so profound to see these women owning their lives, having autonomy, and it's just showing this slice of America and how universal it is. And it is just an example of the success of that show is just an example of how hungry we are to see our stories and our family stories on screen. So very well done to Stars for P-Valley. Little Fires Everywhere is Reese Witherspoon and Kerry Washington's just every role that they have played in their career has been leading up to Little Fires Everywhere. It's so fantastic, and how they deal with race and class and motherhood and the intersection of all of those things. It is an example also of an adaptation of a novel that takes that novel and the premise of that novel to the next level. So it's exciting to watch. It's very, very satisfying. And when you get to the end of that, it will be a mini series of several hours well spent. So favorite films, I have to say Minari by Lee Isaac Chung, another true story, South Korean immigrants immigrating to rural America in the 1980s. Just fantastic acting from Stephen Young, Yoo-ya Jung, Alan Kim, newcomers, somebody to watch. And it's just a beautiful, beautiful story. If you have a grandmother, you will love Minari. 40-year-old version, also Rada Blank. It's another based on her life story of having a midlife crisis at 40. And it just takes you through Harlem in a way that, you know, we're used to seeing Black stories and New York Black stories from the lens of like Spike Lee. And it just takes it to another level. We don't often get to see what Black women at 40 are thinking and feeling. And it's just hilarious and so, so well done. Fantastic script, fantastic directing from this new first-time director, Rada Blank. Miss Juneteenth, Channing Godfrey Peoples, her debut. Also another story of Black Southern life. And this mother, Nicole Beharie, just fantastic acting there. I hope that Miss Juneteenth is the platform that launches Nicole Beharie to the next level of her career. She is such a gift. I'm Your Woman, Julia Hart. She just has a fantastic way of taking women and putting them in the center of their own stories, just like we rarely get to see. So I'm so, so thankful for this crime noir thriller, I'm Your Woman. It's so satisfying. Ma Rainey's Black Bottom. I could go on.
You could go. You mentioned first that HBO show, I May Destroy, and we recently spoke to its creator, director, writer, producer, lead actress, Michaela Cole, here on 1A. Let's take a listen to what she had to say about that show.
It's a TV series. It's 12 episodes long, and it's initially inspired by my own life. I had the unfortunate circumstance of being drugged and assaulted. And so I guess I wanted to write the story because I think part of recovery is writing and sharing. But then from that, I found all these other stories. And so the series is exploring consent and the line between sexual exploitation and liberation in the modern day. It's also about friendship and about thinking and curiosity and how we identify and how well we know ourselves as human beings, I guess.
Eric Deggans, I know this didn't make your top three, but you watched the series and liked it, I gather. What about it made it stand out to you?
It was my very next one. if I was going to go past my top three, I May Destroy You would have been the fourth one. What I found so amazing about this show was not only was it a really affecting and compelling depiction of a woman, you know, slowly gathering her memories and realizing that she had been drugged and sexually assaulted, but that's just part of the story. It tells a story of the legacy of abuse through generations, how abusers can also be abused, be among the abused, all the different kinds of forms that sexual assault can take for millennials, especially these days. It is a really sort of searching depiction of a lot of different levels of trauma and coping with trauma. I'm just incredibly impressed with Michaela Cole. She is such a talent, and I've loved everything she's been in, from Chewing Gum, this British comedy, to Black Earth Rising, a sobering drama on Netflix. And now she's done this masterpiece. I was really, really affected by it.
Eric Deggans is NPR's TV critic. John Horn is the host of KPCC's The Frame. And Brooke Obi is an award-winning film critic and author. This is 1A from WAMU and NPR. And John, you mentioned a moment ago your favorite film, Nomadland, as you said, set to be released, I think, February the 19th of 2021. You're among the lucky who got to see it early. And I want to play a little bit of that film, if I could. This is actress Frances McDormand as the main character, Fern, and she's responding to questions and some concerns about her life.
You are one of those lucky people that can travel anywhere.
Yes, ma'am, I know.
And they sometimes call you nomads.
My mom said that you're homeless. Is that true?
No, I'm not homeless. I'm just houseless. Not the same thing, right?
No.
My husband worked at the USG mine in Empire. I was a substitute teacher.
It is a tough time right now. You may want to consider early retirement.
I need work. I like work.
Sean, there's a documentary-like quality to what we heard there. Just explain a bit more about how the movie plays out and why it spoke to you, especially at this moment.
Well, it's based on a really, really good book by Jessica Bruder. And I would recommend, if you're going to go see the film, and generally I don't suggest this, read the book first and then see the movie. What this movie is about, and we talked about this a little bit earlier, are people on the margins. You know, and it's not just the people who are sleeping on the sidewalk that you step around. It's the invisible poor. And it's a story about poverty. It's a story about people, you know, forming communities to try to get by. When you open an Amazon box after you see this film, you will think about what's inside that box in a very different way, because a lot of these people do seasonal work at Amazon fulfillment centers, and it's a huge part of the book. It's a smaller part of the movie. In fact, Frances McDormand in this film actually does work in an Amazon fulfillment center. She also does some other jobs, including sugar beet harvesting, because that's the story of what these people are doing seasonally to get by. So I think it's really, and because it's populated by all of these real nomads, it is a portrait of a country that we don't see, we don't acknowledge. And these are people who, well before the pandemic, were barely getting by. And it's about the marginalized. It's about the people who have suffered some sort of setback that wasn't necessarily their own fault. There's a reference there to Empire, which was a city that a gypsum company ran that closed up overnight. And all these people were displaced and they had nothing to do. They worked there for decades and now they had no job. So it's really a story about capitalism. It's a story about surviving. It's a story about friendship. And it's incredibly moving. And Chloe Zhao is such a great filmmaker, very naturalistic, not a lot of fancy camera work or score or anything. It's an observation of life of people that we don't necessarily observe or even notice.
John Horn is the host of KPCC's The Frame. Brooke Obi is an award-winning film critic and author. Eric Deggans is NPR's TV critic. And a lot of listeners writing in, wistful, optimistic that TV and movies will return to the cinema once again. Kokomo Kid tweeting, with big screen TVs getting cheaper and streaming an option for all content, movie theaters are finished. I just hope live theater can recover after COVID subsides. And Catherine emailing, OMG, the thought of having to watch great movies on a computer or even a TV is heartbreaking. The experience of being in a dark theater, totally engrossed in the experience of the story on the screen, cannot be duplicated outside of a movie theater. unless you're wealthy enough to afford a movie screen at home. There goes that top 1% advantage again. This would be a huge loss. I'm David Gura, in for Jen White. We'll hear much more from you and our guests in a moment. Let's get back to talking about some of our favorite movies and TV shows of the year. Here with Eric Deggans, NPR's TV critic, John Horn, the host of KPCC's The Frame, and Brooke Obie, who's an award-winning film critic and author. And Eric Deggans, a moment ago, you were talking about your favorite TV show of the year, HBO's Lovecraft Country, and we got an email from Janet in Cincinnati saying, definitely Lovecraft Country, great writing, acting, and visual effects, and I'm so very glad to see leading actors that don't look like me. This is, as you mentioned, a horror drama based in the 1950s, and I want to get a taste of it here. This is Atticus getting a letter offering answers about his mother's heritage that makes him want to begin a dangerous road trip across the country. He's talking to his Uncle George in this clip, played by Courtney B. Vance.
Said he found out where her family came from. He wanted me to come home so I could go there with him.
He's still obsessing over her ancestry. I thought he'd given all that up when she passed.
I know that, like your mother, you think that you can forget the past. He can't. The past is a living thing. You own it, owe it. Now, I have found something about your mother's forebears. You have a sacred, secret legacy, a birthright that's been kept from you.
That's strange. That don't really even sound like your father.
I haven't even gotten to the strange part. The place he wants me to go with him? It's in Lovecraft Country.
Hasn't even gotten to the strange part. Eric Deggans, what can viewers expect after that? Why'd you enjoy this series so much?
Oh, my man. Well, it's really hard to describe this show because they really packed a ton of storylines and references and allegories into the 10 episodes of this series. But basically, this family finds out that they have a legacy in sorcery that brings them into conflict with a white family that is also adept at sorcery, that's trying to achieve something nefarious. And so they come into conflict. And this white family needs the blood of the character that you heard, Atticus, in order to complete the spell that they want to cast to achieve what they want to achieve. I don't want to give away too much, but you really have to watch it because, you know, during the course of these episodes, they managed to recreate pivotal civil rights moments in civil rights and racism, including the death of Emmett Till and including the Tulsa race massacre. They also managed to draw a lot of allegories between, horrific monsters and the horrors of racism. And it's particularly poignant. It's based on a book, but it's particularly poignant because, H.P. Lovecraft, who inspired some of the monsters and some of the situations in the show and in the book, was also known as someone who was xenophobic and something of a racist. So to take his work and kind of put it to work, telling a story that elevates a black family and talks about the black family heritage and black agency, you know, that is a masterful turn. And so you can watch it as someone who doesn't know anything about this and enjoy the story. But once you know some of the things that they're referencing, the satisfaction in watching this gets even deeper.
That, of course, on Eric Deggans' top three list. You can check out all these lists on our website, the1a.org. And Eric Deggans, you mentioned a moment ago, another of your favorites was The Queen's Gambit. And if there were cultural phenomenon during the course of this pandemic, this was certainly one of them. I think it was a record for Netflix in terms of how many people watched that show. What spoke to you about it? You made a joke on NPR that you should get an award for best revival of a board game. Why did this series about a chess prodigy appeal to so many people, do you think?
Well, you know, all these people are rushing out to find out about how chess works, yeah, and got into playing chess more. And so that's a wonderful thing because it's a great game. But the story itself, I think also, you know, it's about this young woman. She finds herself orphaned at an early age. She's raised in an orphanage, but discovers that she has this prodigious talent at chess. She first starts out by playing with the custodian at the orphanage where she's you know, being raised, and then later realizes that she can make money by winning tournaments, and then sets her goal to win the world championship against, you know, some of the greatest chess players of the day. And it's a story of overcoming the sexism of the times because it's set in the 1950s and 1960s. She has developed something of a substance abuse habit inside the orphanage because they used tranquilizers, sedatives, to tranquilize the students. And so she developed kind of a dependence on that that extended into her adult years. So she has to deal with that. And she also has to deal with all this sort of damaging trauma. Her mother, you know, was imparting what she thought was life lessons to her, but they were very damaging and kind of distorted. And those quote unquote lessons began to surface as she becomes an adult and make it harder for her to connect to other people in the world. So, you know, as you can tell, it's a really complex story. And in addition to all of that, they actually managed to make playing chess a dramatic and compelling activity. And you're watching these people. There are a lot of chess games that are reenacted in this show, and every one of them is interesting, even if you have no idea how the game works. But if you know how the game works, then you really enjoy it because they didn't fake it. They put together matches that actually make sense when you know how the game operates. So my hats off to Scott Frank, who was the driving force in creating this and directing the episodes and writing it. He also did something called Godless, mm-hmm, on Netflix, which was a great Western. So you could tell this guy's really talented, but I think he really hit the ball out of the park with this one.
Getting a number of listeners saying that they enjoyed the show The Undoing. Lisa emailing, favorite show is The Undoing. Nicole Kidman and Hugh Grant are such great actors. Hugh Grant should play the bad guy more often. Nicole Kidman just gets more beautiful as time goes on. Another listener emailing, my favorite show hands down was The Undoing. Everything about it was amazing, but Nicole Kidman and Hugh Grant were outstanding. We're talking to Eric Deggans, NPR's TV critic, John Horn, host of KPCC's The Frame, and Brooke Obie, an award-winning film critic and author. And John, you mentioned this film, 76 Days, takes you inside those hospitals in Wuhan in China at the beginning of this outbreak. And so many of us have watched or heard so much news coverage of this pandemic. What makes this different? What makes it have added value to those who've watched this pandemic unfold in real time?
I mean, this is a part of the story you haven't seen. And this is, you know, not only about what is going on in China, and China has obviously been marginalized in this entire conversation and blamed for what's been happening. This is a story about heroism. These are superheroes. These are no Wonder Women. These are people who are traveling into the pandemic from other cities in China to treat patients. And again, because of the protocols in place, they are gowned and masked, and you really don't see their faces or know their names, because even though there are subtitles, it's all in Chinese, and it's hard to recognize the names that are written on the back of their gowns. But it's really about, like, the sacrifice that people make to take care of those who are sick, and about, you know, how bad this pandemic is. There are scenes early on in the film where people who might be sick or think they might be sick are trying to get into the hospital. And it's literally, they are storming the doors. And there are these nurses trying to hold the doors closed so that dozens of people don't run into the hospital and try to get care. And there are these beautiful personal moments. There's one nurse who is charged with returning the mobile phones of people who have died to their families. And she's cleaning these phones, like one of them rings when she has it in her hand. And that's pretty much, you know, what is left of these people's lives are these phones. And there are a lot of people who survive. So it's a complex story of care and survival and loss, But the access inside the hospital is unlike anything you've ever seen. I mean, they are everywhere. They are with the patients. They are in operating rooms. They're showing them dying. They're showing them getting released. In fact, one of the filmmakers worked anonymously because he was afraid of reprisals from the Chinese government. It was edited back in the United States by a filmmaker named Hao Wu. It's spellbinding. It's really a good film. And I think it really reinforces in every viewer's mind how important it is that we support caregivers and make sure that we recognize the sacrifice that they are taking every hour of every day.
That film is called 76 Days, and we'll move from documentary here to comedy. If you'll indulge me, Brooke, I'll go back to you. You mentioned that film, The 40-Year-Old Version. Going to enunciate that properly for our listeners. We're not talking about the Steve Carell movie of a similar sounding name. These are different movies, albeit both comedies. What was it about this movie? Why did you like it so much? And this is another film, another project that features one incredibly talented individual doing so much, acting in it, directing it, writing the screenplay, producing the film as well.
Yes. So Rada Blank is telling the story. It's basically her own story. She was, in fact, a young playwright who got one of those coveted and pressure-inducing 30 Under 30 awards. And then it fast forwards, you know, 10 years later, and what has happened, you know, being stifled, especially, you know, as a Black woman creative, the things that the people with power tell you that you have to do in order to succeed, the ways that you have to shrink yourself, shrink your stories, accept changes and notes from people who have no idea about the stories that you want to tell and the way that you should be telling them and have no idea on how to guide you in telling your best stories. And so there's a lot of frustration in this movie that I think so many Black creatives can relate to, and anyone who is in a situation where they're being stifled or their voices are being controlled. And so she just has this really, really hilarious way of laughing at the industry, and laughing at the ways that our stories are shaken up. And so what she ends up doing is providing a source of an outlet for all of that frustration. She's channeling it into this rap career. And so we see her going in a completely different direction, and what that rap career ends up doing, even though it's so far away from the stage and the prestige of theater. She's actually unlocking who she really is. And by unlocking who she really is, she's able to go back to theater and take control of her story and take control of the message and provide perhaps a pathway for other people who are watching as well. It's just delightful. It's so funny. And Rada Blank, from writing, directing, and starring in her own story, is just so talented. So I can't wait to see what she does next.
John, we started out by talking about postponement and the decision so many of these studios made to postpone the release of movies, particularly big budget movies. Let's look forward as we look backward. I mean, what are you looking forward to in 2021?
Well, one of the things I'm concerned about, because Brooks' films, Minari, Miss Juneteenth, and 40-Year-Old Version, all played at the Sundance Film Festival in January of this year. That festival is going to be scaled back dramatically because of the pandemic. So the ability of films to come out of Sundance and get traction or get distribution is going to be probably severely curtailed. Eric talked about Scott Frank and Queen's Gambit. I've known Scott for years. He said to me that Queen's Gambit took years to get made. So the fact that these movies are out there and these shows are succeeding is almost still a fluke. So I'm really concerned about what happens next. The good news, I think, and not to knock Wonder Woman, this is a movie that doesn't seem to be doing really well. The franchise business, which Hollywood, you know, relies upon, the Marvel movies, the Star Wars movies, yeah. It requires big theatrical box office, and that part of the equation is gone, because these movies cost about $500 million to produce and release. So if the financial model for making them is gone, maybe, and I'm really hopeful here, the studios will rethink their, you know, approach to filmmaking and say, maybe we should make smaller movies. Maybe we should make adult dramas. Maybe we should hire independent filmmakers who can work fast, don't have big casts, you know, don't cost a lot of money. maybe there's going to be a fundamental realignment of our priorities as filmmakers, because look at what's succeeding. I mean, look at a show like Unorthodox on Netflix. Mm-hmm. Who would have thunk? Who would think that a series about chess would be second only to The Crown at Netflix? The audience is hungry for original stories that haven't been told. So I would hope the studios listen and don't make the 17th Marvel movie, but make something that's original and new, because the audience is hungry for it. And thank goodness, maybe the financial model is going to accelerate that change.
Brooke, does hope spring eternal there? Do you agree with John? Do you share some of his optimism?
I am hopeful. I really am hopeful. But I do also, with that, as studios are acknowledging how much audiences are hungry, not only for that, but representation as well, that there will be some more careful consideration to the representation that we are going to be receiving in these new projects that will be coming out, because we have so many fantastic shows and TVs, shows and movies that we've just discussed, but there were some problematic ones as well. We still have, you know, dealing with colorism, we're still dealing with fat phobia, we're still dealing with, you know, actors wanting to play roles that perhaps should not be theirs to play, such as the story of trans people, you know, so we still are dealing with a lot of these things. So I'm hoping in the future, in the next iteration of the shows that will and films will be receiving, that there will be careful consideration to the representation that we'll be receiving, and that the communities whose stories are going to be told will see themselves reflected and also be a part of the productions as they're being made.
I think that's a great note to end on. Brooke Obie, thank you very much. She's an award-winning film critic and author. Eric Deggans is NPR's TV critic. And John Horn is the host of KPCC's The Frame. Remember, 1A is on Instagram. You can follow us at The 1A Show. Today's producer was Katie Klein. The program comes to you from WAMU, part of American University in Washington, distributed by NPR. I'm David Gura. Let's talk more soon. This is 1A.